Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Bernie Sanders yesterday introduced his single payer bill into the U.S. Congress with increasing support from Democrats. Not surprising, given that the polls show that people in the U.S. increasingly support single payer. We speak with Egan Kemp, an expert on single payer systems and a healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen. The relationship between hurricanes like Harvey and Irma and climate change. Residents of Houston, from both upscale and inner city neighborhoods, are grappling with health results, including exposure to E. coli bacteria, as well as other impacts as a result of fecal matter in flood waters. This, in addition to chemicals and other toxins. We likely will see similar results in Florida, where there are also growing concerns about an explosion of the mosquito population. But developers, whose first concern is profit, have been building over swamps and floodplains in both Houston and Florida. Will there be enough public pressure and acknowledgement of climate change that increases the ferocity of these hurricanes to shift where cities are further developed? Our guest is Stan Cox, a research coordinator at the Land Institute and editor at Green Social Thought. And what is going on with the North American Free Trade Agreement, NAFTA, now being renegotiated? What could be the impacts on both sides of the border? We speak with Mexico City-based journalist, analyst, and activist Laura Carlson. Also, community organizer with the Strategy Center, Eric Mann, fills us in on the death of Cesar Rodriguez, who was hit by an MTA Blue Line train in Los Angeles as a result of police brutality. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. President Trump appeared to contradict congressional Democratic leaders today over their assertion that they'd reached an agreement with Trump on legislation to protect undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children from deportation. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said there's an agreement on turning the Obama-era Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals program into law. They say Trump said he'd encourage the House and Senate to act. The leaders also say both sides agreed to work out a U.S.-Mexico border security package, but it wouldn't include Trump's border wall. They say Trump made clear he'll pursue that later. Trump sent out a series of tweets this morning taking issue with those characterizations of what was agreed to at a White House dinner last night. Trump tweeted, quote, "No deal was made last night on DACA. Massive border security would have to be agreed to in exchange for consent, would be subject to vote." President Trump heads to Florida today to review Hurricane Irma damage. Emergency workers around Florida worked to make sure elderly residents were safe, evacuating multiple assisted living facilities after 8 seniors died in a sweltering nursing home that lost its air conditioning in the storm. In one of the latest actions to protect older residents, firefighters helped relocate 122 people Wednesday from 2 assisted living centers near Orlando that had been without power since Hurricane Irma struck. Stepped-up efforts came after the 8 deaths at the rehabilitation center at Hollywood Hills, which shocked Florida's top leaders even as they surveyed destruction from a storm that spread its punishing effects across the entire state. Senator Marco Rubio of Florida told CNN he'd like to see government review of how senior care is delivered during crises.
"This storm has exposed a very dangerous vulnerability in our network of senior care. I was emailing with Susan Collins this morning, who's Senator Collins is the chairman of the Aging Committee in the Senate. I'd like for us to really look into that issue, maybe even hold some field hearings if possible, to study this from a broader perspective."
In Coral Gables, an apartment building was evacuated after authorities said it lacks power and made it unsafe for elderly tenants. And at a 15,000-resident retirement community in Pembroke Pines, rescue workers went door-to-door in the 94-degree heat, checking on residents and bringing ice, water, and meals. Four Republican senators are introducing a long-shot attempt to roll back much of Obamacare. The senators unveiled their legislation Wednesday on Capitol Hill. The legislation seeks to do away with the various subsidies and mandates that encompass the current health law and instead provide block grants to the states to help individuals pay for health coverage. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham.
Under this block grant approach, you can actually complain to a state house representative who probably lives in your neighborhood, goes to the same hospital you send your family. You can complain to a governor that you can vote for.
The GOP senators say states are better equipped than Washington to determine how best to meet the needs of their residents. Senator Bernie Sanders introduced a Medicare for All single-payer health care bill Wednesday. The Vermont Independent garnered support from 16 Senate Democrats. Some of them, like California's Kamala Harris, Massachusetts' Elizabeth Warren, and Sanders himself, have been mentioned as possible 2020 presidential candidates. And, as Christopher Martinez reports, single-payer may finally be ready for prime time.
Single-payer health care, or Medicare for All, was a key issue in Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders' campaign for president. Now, after the failure of Republican attempts to repeal Obamacare, Sanders is reintroducing his Medicare for All Senate bill. He says supporters of his measure are proclaiming that health care must be a right, not a privilege. If nothing else, the bill is now changing the terms of debate on health care. In the past, politicians and candidates often dismissed single-payer health care as unrealistic, as did Hillary Clinton during the presidential primaries. Now it's no longer a fringe issue, but a serious policy proposal that politicians will have to address head-on. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News, KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The University of California, Berkeley, has ramped up security as it braces to host right-wing commentator and former Breitbart editor Ben Shapiro tonight. He's the latest polarizing figure to raise concerns of possible violence on the flagship campus of the UC Berkeley system. Campus Republicans invited Shapiro to speak, and they argue that the liberal university stifles conservative speech. Scheduled speeches from right-wing provocateurs Milo Yiannopoulos and Ann Coulter earlier this year led to violent demonstrations and the cancellation of those talks. I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Right here at the top of the hour, I'd like to welcome Eric Mann, veteran organizer with the Strategy Center and host of Voices from the Front Lines on Pacifica Radio's KPFK. Just a terrible situation has happened where a young man, Cesar Rodriguez, was killed and hit by an MTA Blue Line train in L.A., Los Angeles, as a result of police brutality. Eric, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Margaret. I really appreciate it.
Right. So what happened, Eric? What happened, Eric?
Well, I'll start with what happened to the brother, and then I want to put it in the context of our campaign. I wrote an article called The Murder of the Unknown Rider, Counterpunch. And we didn't even know who. We heard that an unknown rider was killed by an MTA train, allegedly because of problems with fare checking, and then allegedly because of narcotics. So I wrote this article saying we don't even know who he is, but he's probably black. He could be Latino. He's not a white lawyer. We know that. And why were they patting him down in the first place? It turns out he's Latino. His name is Cesar Rodriguez. He had been in prison for something he didn't do from 16 to 22. He died at 23. The Strategy Center went to East L.A., and he's a real person with a real family, as are all the black and Latino writers. And he has a beautiful family. We met with his Lillian, his girlfriend. His mother is amazing. His sister, Avelia, and they were in East L.A. They have found the body. There are bruises to the head, which indicated maybe that he was hit by police. And we're having a demonstration today in front of the MTA at 12 o'clock saying all police off the trains, no fare collection, get your hands off us. You know, the way they're treating Black and Latino riders on the MTA is criminal and racist. And then they had a, Margaret, they had a fundraising party in Boyle Heights the Friday night to raise money for his funeral. It was raided by the police.
What?
And they arrested his girlfriend. Mm. And they said, we know who you are. And so basically, as you know, in the Black and Latino community, it's a true army of occupation. And we can't get any help. We're demonstrating in front of the MTA to say, stop MTA genocide against the Black nation, because we think that the death of this Latino brother is part of the overall reign of terror against Black and Latino riders, and we need people's help.
And for people who can't make it today but who want to support this effort and also the Strategy Center's effort for the fight for the soul of the cities, what should they do, Eric?
I mean, if you could please send us an email at info@thestrategycenter.org. Call us at 213-387-2800. And if you have suffered any form of police harassment on MTA trains or buses, especially, we're looking for declarants because we're also bringing a civil rights suit against
right.
them. And Margaret, thank you for how you allow your show to be so available to the movement. It's deeply moving.
Right. Well. Thank you. We wanted to make sure that we got this in. As you know, when we found out about this, our show was already planned and packed. But we appreciate you, Eric, and our sympathy, our hearts really go out to the family of Cesar Rodriguez, 23-year-old Latino male, to lose his life in such a brutal and tragic way. Thank you, Eric.
Take good care of yourself.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Bernie Sanders introduced legislation on Wednesday, September 13th, 2017, that would expand Medicare into a universal health care insurance for all in the United States, along with a record level of support of at least 16 Senate Democrats. There's some outlets that are saying 15 Democratic senators. What we'd like to do now before welcoming our guests is we'd just like to do a roundup from the Washington Post of what is single-payer health care and contrasting what Bernie and progressive Democrats are supporting as opposed to what the Republicans and conservatives are. Let's go to that clip now.
Healthcare in the United States is going through a political reckoning, with lots of ideas on how to reform or completely change the way people get and pay for health insurance. Many on the right want to move toward a more privately run system, with less insurance requirements on individuals, health insurance companies, and employers, and less government subsidies and funding.
We want all the providers of healthcare services, insurers, doctors, hospitals, everyone, competing against each other for our business as patients. As consumers.
But Republicans are splintered on just how to roll back the government's role in individuals' health care, something that came to a head when four different plans failed to pass the Senate in July. The left, on the other hand, wants to boost those public government programs and coverage requirements to give more Americans health insurance.
Democrats believe that health care is a right for all.
One of their buzziest ideas is single-payer health care, where the government is the single payer that pays for Americans' health insurance through a tax-funded plan. Single payer is a type of universal health coverage. That's where the government ensures that every citizen has health insurance. There are lots of ways for governments to implement universal health coverage. At least 30 countries have some form of it. The way our system works right now, there are a good deal of Americans who don't have health insurance. In 2016, about 28 million, roughly 9% of the population, were uninsured. And those who are insured have to work with a web of private insurance companies, employers, hospitals, pharmaceutical companies, and government-funded programs like Medicaid and Medicare. Single-payer would funnel all of those negotiations into one channel, where the government determines a baseline of health benefits that it will fund for everyone and sets or negotiates the price for those benefits. just like there are many ways to get to universal health coverage, there are also multiple ways to implement a single-payer healthcare system. Bernie Sanders and some Democrats are backing a Medicare for All proposal. This would expand Medicare, which currently pays for certain health services for Americans over 65 and those with disabilities, to all Americans. Polling shows that a majority of Americans believe that it's the government's responsibility to provide healthcare coverage, and a growing share of Americans support single-payer healthcare. Those in favor of Medicare for All say that the plan would lower prices for healthcare services and medicine across the board. Americans pay double what many countries with universal health coverage do on health costs, and many say that those costs would be lower if the government could bargain down or set prices. Conservatives are largely against Medicare for All because it would shift more costs and responsibilities to the government and away from the private market, thus requiring more tax dollars to implement.
Get Washington out of the business of being a nanny state.
They contend that it would take away individual choice in health coverage.
This complete government takeover of health care.
Although liberals who support the plan argue the exact opposite.
The choice they made is they want to get quality health care.
And many moderates say that the transition to a single-payer system would be tricky and could upend health insurance coverage if done too rapidly. But with public perception warming up to single-payer and more Democrats jumping on board, we could see more of these proposals in the run-up to big elections in 2018 and 2020.
That was from the Washington Post. I'd like to welcome Egan Kemp. Egan is a healthcare policy advocate at Public Citizen. He's an expert in single-payer systems, private health insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, the Children's Health Insurance Program, the Veterans Health Administration, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, social determinants of health, mental health, and drug shortages. He was previously a senior policy analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Egan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Egan, an exciting time here. Robert Wiseman, also with your organization, has said that Sanders' Medicaid for All legislation is the right thing to do politically, economically, and morally. Now, we are seeing, though, with the 2018 election coming up and people making all kinds of political calculations, those who are up for re-election, that according to Pew, 60% of people are saying that the federal government is responsible for ensuring healthcare coverage for all in the United States, 39% not, right? But right. In terms of single payer, overall 33% of the public now favors single payer, and that's up 5 percentage points since January, 12 percentage points since 2014. People are still going to be looking at that 33%. Tell us your assessment of where things are now. You've got these 16 Democrats. You are seeing an uptick in support.
Yeah, we agree. It's a really exciting time for single-payer health care and for Americans to hopefully get the health care system that they really deserve. And we think that it's an important time for folks to understand that, you know, the health care that they have now, we hope that they enjoy it, but there's a lot of folks that are uninsured. As your clip mentioned, around 28 million Americans that are still uninsured, which really puts them at risk of bankruptcy, even if they have one relatively small illness. And a number more millions of folks are underinsured, so they may have high deductibles or high copays, which really create challenges for them, you know, should they get sick. And we've seen that, you know, most folks that go through a Medicare bankruptcy related to medical costs already had insurance at the time.
Right. So help our audience to understand what's actually in this Sanders bill.
Yeah. So the Sanders bill, it would improve Medicaid and Medicare and expand it to all Americans. So the goal really there is that, you know, anyone who comes to the U.S., a resident to the U.S., or who's born in the U.S., would then be on the system. They'd be given a card. They would be able to go to any doctor in the country that's available, and they would be able to get care, you know, first dollar care, meaning that there's not sort of upfront payments that they would have to make. They're not going to be getting a bill. And the only cost sharing so far would be for some prescription drugs, limited cost sharing depending on your income. And this is, would be a great system for Americans to finally be able to get the care that they need. We know that a lot of Americans go without care either due to expense or due to challenges finding someone that takes their insurance.
Right. And I mean, on the face of it, a lot of things, likely a lot of our listeners would support. Youths under the age of 18 would immediately obtain universal Medicare cards, emergency surgery to prescription drugs, from mental health to eye care, all would be covered with no copay. And people not currently eligible for Medicare would be phased into the program over 4 years. So there is that. And also private insurance insurers would also remain. But one thing that changed from when Bernie was campaigning is that the new bill doesn't specify how to finance the new health benefits. And when he was campaigning for president, he talked about a new set of taxes. Any thoughts on that?
That's something that is still being discussed, and I know that they want to have this discussion about sort of whether people can agree that all Americans have a right to health care, and we're seeing a lot of movement on that issue and a lot of support. But I know that they plan to release funding sources, potential options soon. They wanted to get the discussion going sort of on the policy side and whether, we can come to agreement on this issue that all Americans deserve the right to health care, and then really have the discussion of what that means in terms of how you would fund it, what the final goals would be, what the final plan would look like as we, discuss and debate the passage and implementation of such a bill.
Okay. So what about we see people like Cory Booker of New Jersey, Kamala Harris of California, Elizabeth Warren of Massachusetts, all kind of being discussed as possible presidential candidates in the next run. Who are some of the key Democrats that are not signed on? Because there's also a House bill, right? There's a House version of this bill, which people don't know a lot about, this single-payer bill in the House.
Yeah, so I can touch on both of those. Yeah, in the House, it's called H.R. 676, and John Conyers, Representative Conyers, has been introducing that for a number of years. He's now at a record number of co-sponsors, 118, a majority of the House Democratic Caucus, and so that's a bill that continues to get a lot of support. It's similar to the Sanders bill in a number of ways, with a few differences just in terms of how it's structured, how quickly it's implemented. It has a shorter transition than the Sanders bill, but we think both bills are really strong single-payer proposals. And in terms of Democrats that are not currently on the bill, that's something that, we're continuing to talk to offices. We know that there's a lot of interest on single payer. Even Senator John Tester this week talked about, wanting to have the discussion on single payer. So we don't think this is the final list of folks that are going to be co-sponsoring. We think there's a lot of interest out there, and we're really hoping that everyone will reach out to their senators and let them know, their thoughts, their concerns about single payer, because we want this to be a discussion. We want everyone to be comfortable about where we're going.
Right. Well, there certainly doesn't seem to be consensus among Democrats on this. And then on the GOP side, you've got people like Lindsey Graham, threatening to derail the entire thing. And if you look at the Democratic leadership on the Hill, Nancy Pelosi in the House and Chuck Schumer in the Senate, neither of whom at this point are supporting. I mean, what are they kind of allowing the process to move forward, but strategically not actively working for it? Or are they actively working to undermine it, as far as you know?
Yeah, as far as I know, it looks like they want to create the space where we can have the discussion. And I know that they've both got, big fights on their hands. Recently, Nancy Pelosi, Representative Pelosi, mentioned that she's got to defend the ACA, and that's an important fight. And you mentioned the Graham-Cassidy bill. These battles are ongoing, and so if they're not ready to turn to single payer, that's part of their decision as leaders. But we think that they have important that work that they're doing, you know, protecting our care, and we hope that they'll eventually get on board and, you know, look forward to continue having discussions with them.
Yeah, finally, I'm wondering, I didn't see the poll, the polling on independence, but also given the recent tragedies in Houston and also in Florida with the hurricanes and a lot of people who were opposed to government intervention and people just taking care of themselves, maybe having some second thoughts now because a lot of them need help from the federal government. Do you think that this might have an impact then on how people are seeing healthcare? I mean, there are a lot of, we're going to be talking later in the hour about the health impacts on both of these hurricanes in both Houston as well as Florida. Just some final thoughts from you.
Yeah, I think that's a very important connection to make. And, you know, the social determinants of health are an important aspect of all of this. It's really a question of whether we're all in this together as one country looking out for each other or whether we're all sort of on our own and responsible for our own health. And I hope the American people can see that, you know, in emergency situations, we really need to be there for each other. And with 30 million Americans still uninsured, we really need to be there for them as well and making sure that they can get the care that they need.
Right. There is one other quick thing. I cannot neglect this, which is the California single-payer bill, SB 562. The California Nurses Association, a prime driver behind this legislation. And a lot of people thought that this was actually going to just go through, and it seems to be stuck in committee somewhere. But I think people are still hoping that California can kind of set the bar and be an example for how single-payer could work. Any quick thoughts on the California situation?
Yeah, we understand that the California measure is still moving forward, and I want to echo the strong support that nurses are giving it out there. We really appreciate all the support that nurses have give across the country, both sort of in their daily work and also advocating on behalf of their patients for policies like single payer. And so they've been great advocates, and I think they'll continue to have success in California. They're really pushing that effort forward and holding folks accountable.
Right, and again, that bill moved out of the state Senate, again, without identifying a revenue source to fund it. So it seems as though on both the California level as well as the national level, the funding of these things have to be sorted out. But this is encouraging news indeed, Egan Kemp, the United States being one of the few developed nations in the world not giving people access to universal health care as a right. So we appreciate your efforts and we look forward to progress in all of this. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. And almost 24 years ago, Bill Clinton signed off on the North American Free Trade Agreement, creating a trilateral free trade bloc between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada, repealing tariffs on goods shipped between the three countries. Since then, NAFTA, as it is known, has been criticized internationally for its neoliberal agenda of putting corporations before people. You know, a lot of people wonder the meaning of this neoliberal, that word neoliberal. I'll ask Laura Carlson, our guest, on that. In any case, what a lot of people remember about the launch of NAFTA was the Zapatistas in Chiapas in Mexico. The Zapatistas famously went public on the same day NAFTA began as part of criticizing the agreement and making their presence known. The deal has been a target of progressive people and, interestingly enough, of Donald Trump, who during the 2016 election called NAFTA catastrophic and the single worst trade deal ever approved in this country. Now the U.S., Mexico, and Canada are participating in private renegotiations of NAFTA. The first round of talks was held in Washington, D.C. in August. The second was held in Mexico City this month. But what will come out of these talks is up in the air, and there's a lot of fear that what Trump's team is bringing to the negotiating table perhaps is more of the same. The National Observer, U.S., arrived with text copied straight from the Trans-Pacific partnership. That's according to the National Observer. On Mexico's side, Trump has put pressure on the country due to the U.S.-Mexico trade deficit. That and other areas of conflicts, like Mexico's low wages, have been a point of debate thus far. Indeed, let us go to a clip from Al Jazeera about Mexican workers and how Mexico workers' rights are at the top of the agenda of NAFTA talks, or I think some would hope that's the case.
Mexico's salaries are the lowest in the international economic body, the OECD. So low that in the NAFTA renegotiations, the USA is complaining they mean unfair competition for its workforce. But why is that? For labor experts, this is a big part of the answer.
The reason salaries are low in Mexico is that there aren't any unions to regulate working conditions or fair pay.
In Mexico, labor experts say the vast majority of unions exist only on paper. They're known as protectionist or ghosts, set up and controlled by the very companies to which they should be a counterweight. Leo Reyes says that's the situation in the plant of Japanese firm Honda in western Mexico, where he's worked for 17 years.
When I started here, they made me join a union I never knew about. What does the union do for workers? Practically nothing. It's on the company's side. It takes no notice when we ask for higher salaries, and it lessens the benefits that we get.
Workers at the plant say they were fired for trying to form their own union. Honda didn't respond to our interview request. There are legislative efforts to curb ghost unions, but they're being resisted. And not just by companies, but the country's biggest confederation of unions itself, the CTM. Experts say it sticks up for firms rather than workers.
The CTM's first position was against raising the minimum salary. That doesn't happen anywhere in the world.
CTM leader Carlos Aceves wouldn't give Al Jazeera an interview. Even in the minority of Mexican unions which do defend the workforce, leaders are notorious for getting rich off membership quotas and backhanders from company contracts.
Whether it's from genuine unions, but with grasping leaders, or even worse, ghost unions, Mexican workers rarely get effective representation. And there's a certain irony that it's the administration of President Trump, an arch enemy for many Mexicans, that's trying to change that in the NAFTA renegotiations.
Of course, the U.S. administration has ulterior motives, but for labor experts, the outside intervention is still welcome.
The only thing we can thank President Trump for is the fact he's making us have a national debate over our economic model.
There's hope that pressure could force the Mexican government to deliver a better deal for the workforce.
What I'd like to do, though, is to welcome Laura Carlson, a regular here on Sojourner Truth, political analyst, journalist, writer based in Mexico. She's written extensively on NAFTA, the drug war, immigration, and gender issues in a number of outlets. Laura Carlson, welcome.
Thank you, Margaret.
Okay, so Laura, I know you've been following this, likely writing about this. Your thoughts now on how these renegotiations are going and what are the issues at stake?
Well, first of all, on the wage issue, which has become one of the most prominent issues in the second round of negotiations that ended in Mexico last week, I think, is that I completely agree with Donald Trump. I never thought I'd be saying that. But in this sense, the fact that Mexico has permitted low wages, and this is not as a result of market forces or the free market, as many would say, but as a result of artificially enforcing wages down, is really a very serious problem in trade relations. Not only does it mean that workers are not paid their due in Mexico, where the minimum wage is approximately $4 a day, not an hour a day, but it also means that corporations have this incentive to go to Mexico to move their production into Mexico to be able to take advantage of this cheap labor. Not only is it cheap labor, but because they have what they call contracts of protection contracts, which has also been a point that's been raised in the context of the negotiations. It means that the workers don't have any real representation in many of these offshore assembly plants and in all other workplaces throughout the country as well. So we're in an interesting position where this has become an issue. Canada has made it an issue, and they've said the unions have made it an issue as well, saying that there has to be an increase in wages in Mexico so that workers have a fair deal in the three countries, and that becomes a factor that enters into the trade negotiations themselves. Now, Mexico immediately said, no way, wage policy is an internal issue. They said, you can't set, there's no precedent for setting a wage level for another country in a trade agreement. But that response was a dodge, because in fact, all that agreement has to say is that Mexico is required to fulfill its own labor laws in order to bring about a wage increase in Mexico, because the Constitution says that workers should be able to earn a decent living that provides for the basic necessities of both them and their families. And that hasn't been happening for many, many years in Mexico, especially since the age of NAFTA and slightly before then, when Mexico became a neoliberal country, which is to say it went to this economic model that put the emphasis on exports, that put the emphasis on opening up the economy to transnational corporations. There's been disastrous results to that. Within the negotiations, the wages have been a big issue. And there's also been issues on intellectual property and others. And so far, it looks like the talks are basically stalled. What they agreed to do is not talk about any issues that were really controversial and try to move forwards on others. But they're also saying that there's a lot of confusion and lack of movement in some ways from the Trump administration itself, which, of course, was the party that asked for this renegotiation, that they're not getting the text. And there's a lot of skepticism about whether they will be able to terminate these negotiations by the end of the year, which is what both the United States and Mexico want because of the electoral cycles in 2018.
Well, let me ask you this. You know, there's a lot of, you know, chatter around with, you know, Trump meeting with the Democrats and, you know, cutting various deals, it is said, with the Democrats and angering, you know, the Republicans, et cetera. And on the issue of NAFTA, there seemed to have been a kind of a coming together or an agreement among progressives and with Trump, with what he was saying, at least during the campaign, about NAFTA. In terms of what you're saying, though, about how the negotiations are going, was this basically rhetoric, right? I mean, or is there a kind of an agreement between Trump and people who have opposed NAFTA? Laura, what's your view
on
this?
You know, Margaret, that's a critical issue because it's been very confusing, I think, to a lot of people. And it is confusing. I think the first point is that you can't confuse a coincidence of positions, say, when two parties have the same position on an issue with agreement. Because the way we got there was entirely different. What Trump is saying as part of his anti-globalist current is that the United States lost in NAFTA, Mexico took advantage of NAFTA, we are going back to being the mightiest country by doing whatever we want in the world, you know, we don't have, you know, a deficit is proof that we lost, which economists completely argue against, and there's good reason to as well. And what the progressives have been saying, what we've been saying all along, is that, no, the problem here doesn't even have to do with national borders. The problem has to do with the fact that what this deal does is favor transnational corporations against small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and workers themselves. So you can see that the logic of the two is completely different, even though in the end, at this particular point, both renegotiation of NAFTA and particularly raising workers' wages this happens to be something that we agree with. Now, what the Trump administration so far is putting on the table is, again, far different from what progressives have been wanting to renegotiate for almost since the beginning of NAFTA. Increased intellectual property rights and much of the stuff that's coming straight out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, because that's what they're bringing to the table on some issues. I disagree with National Observer that they actually brought, you know, a copy of TPP to negotiate there, and I think that has to do with trying to make sure that the globalists don't win out on the anti-globalists within the conservative factions. Mm-hmm. But they are bringing a lot of what was in the TPP there to the table, and that's certainly not what progressives want. We defeated it in the United States, and we're not going to let it slip back in to a NAFTA renegotiation. Intellectual property, increased intellectual property, is nothing more than delivering monopolies to transnational corporations that are already competing in an unfair manner, because free trade is anything but. It's a series of subsidies from the state, from public resources. It's a series of monopoly and concentration mechanisms that have created a situation in which these transnational corporations can come in and take advantage of cheap labor and of natural resources in any part of the world. So the whole myth that this is a battle of one country against another, that the nationalists in the Trump administration and even before Trump have been putting forward, is just that. It's a false narrative that's designed to convince workers, as we saw in the elections, that that this kind of an economic nationalism and a candidate like Donald Trump could actually be in their interest.
Right, right. Well, we're going to have to come back to this really important negotiations. We really appreciate, Laura, you breaking it down for us. And one has to wonder, too, about the impact increasingly as the U.S. has to deal with a multipolar world, with the U.S. not really just running everything on the one hand, and, just also just the response of movements to all of this and the race to the bottom, because at the time that NAFTA was there, there's all the concern about corporations going to where the lowest wages are. And I remember there were a wave of businesses that left Mexico and went to places like China. And then when they left China and going to a place like Vietnam, where wages are even lower, and then some are saying, well, some are coming back to Mexico. So that race to the bottom is still going on. So we have to keep a close eye on all of this, Laura. So we appreciate you and thank you for joining us.
And of course, they are keeping a close eye. You're talking to me now from El Salvador, where there's a big meeting going on the effect of Trump in Central America. And if CAFTA could be involved in some way, which is highly unlikely, there hasn't been talked about that. But this concerns not just people in the United States, what's happening, but it's just amazing to see how worried people throughout the world are about this Trump administration, its unpredictability, and its aggressiveness in many ways.
Right.
So we'll be watching that.
Yeah. So hopefully you'll be able to come back on and give us a bit more info on that. Thank you, Laura. Safe travels. All righty. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. And coming up, we'll be looking at these hurricanes, the relationship with climate change, and how developers are basically ignoring risks to people for their bottom line. Stan Cox is waiting to speak with us. We'll be right back.
The old road is rapidly fading. Please get out of our way now if you can, lend a hand. For the times, they are changing.
the incredible Nina Simone, The Times They Are Changing. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour from 10 this morning for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. We're also on SoundCloud. Just look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. You could also check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org, where our shows are archived, and where we also have descriptions of our archived shows. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the state of Florida. I would now like to welcome our guest, Stan Cox, research coordinator at the Land Institute and editor at Green Social Thought. Prior to that, he was a wheat geneticist at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. His books include Sick Planet, Corporate Food and Medicine, and Losing Our Cool, Uncomfortable Truths About Our Air-Conditioned World. Last year, he co-wrote How the World Breaks, Life in Catastrophe's Path from the Caribbean to Siberia, a book about natural disasters. His articles have appeared in Al Jazeera, Altnet, Counterpunch, The New York Times, The Guardian, and more. Welcome, Stan Cox.
Good to be with you, Margaret.
Okay, so Stan, in the intro at the top of the hour, we raised the issue about the relationship between hurricanes like Harvey and Irma and climate change, the health challenges that people are now facing in Houston, and likely also in Florida, the explosion of mosquitoes that will happen in Florida, but also that developers' first concern seem to be profit, and seems to continue to be that, building over swamps and floodplains in both Houston and Florida. But first, I'd like to ask you, Mother Jones, Eric Holthus, wrote an article in which he said, make no mistake, these storms weren't natural. A warmer, more violent atmosphere heated up by our collective desire to ignore the fact that we live on a planet where such a devastation is possible, juiced Harvey and Irma's destruction. Do you agree with that?
Yes, that's absolutely true. For one thing, the record high temperatures of the sea surface that we've been seeing fed both of these storms, put energy into them, and then the fact that when the atmosphere is warmer, it can hold a lot more water vapor also fed them. Now, you'll hear, and it's true, that greenhouse warming, at least in the near future, is not going to cause more hurricanes, but it's going to, as Eric Holthus said, juice them. And it is like, say, a baseball player taking performance-enhancing drugs. He may not get any more hits than he used to, but more of those hits are going to be home runs, and that's what we're absolutely seeing now.
Yeah, so then break that down to us in terms of, I mean, your Naples was hard hit in Florida with Irma in Florida. And you talk about your parents being at an RV park there. And Naples is known for having a lot of wealthy people. Clearly, they're not in the RV park where your parents were.
Right.
But they're also, as you say, a lot of low-income people and immigrants there. And I saw a horrific piece very, very briefly on CNN, where somebody was talking about an area, an RV area, where that was flooded, and there were a number of people were undocumented, and they were really afraid to come forward, and they were getting no help, and they have no, basically, food and water going on there. I hope we find out more about that situation. But tell us a bit about that, and also with these developers, I mean, they must know, right, when they're building in areas that are vulnerable to flooding.
That's right. People, I'm sure a lot of people thought, Naples got the landfall. Well, that's fine. That's a playground of the rich. And it's true that pretty much all the waterfront property has been bought by people who've put mansions and yacht docks on them and so forth. But when you have an economy like that, you have a much larger population of people who have to come there and actually do the work, and a lot of them are at the other end of the economic spectrum. And once the storm has passed, the rich people, who most of them had another house in another part of the country to go to anyway, and their insurance will rebuild for them and so forth. But people living paycheck to paycheck, this kind of event is what can tip them over into long-term poverty.
Yeah.
Simply not having wherever they lived, whether they rented or owned it, having that destroyed, and having a much tighter rental market, then people can even end up either homeless or having to just move away somewhere else. I saw that inland from Naples, the Immokalee area, where a lot of vegetables are grown, and with a large migrant worker population, that and a lot of them living in the kind of housing that can be destroyed by wind, that things are very hard there.
Yeah, my brother and his family live in Lehigh Acres, and my nephew's place was actually flooded out, and there's still, you know, water there. They have no running water, they have no electricity, and they're being told maybe 2 weeks to a month. And my nephew has asthma, so you could imagine how I'm worried sick about all of that. But 2 years ago, likely without even thinking of a place like Irma, you and your dad wrote this article, "A Rising Tide, Miami is Sinking Beneath the Sea." We only have a few minutes left, but tell us about the risk of cities like Miami and other risk areas that don't seem to bother the developers too much.
Yeah, actually, they got the tagline backwards on that, so that was my son and I who wrote that.
Oh, okay.
And it was an excerpt from our book, How the World Breaks. And that article was about how Miami faces a triple threat of flooding. Water, the rising seas in the Atlantic are flooding. You know, when you get a storm like Irma, then they increase the size of the storm surge, and so they dodged the bullet this time, but a direct hit would be catastrophic for Miami. But behind that, there's the long-term inexorable rise of the water, not only from the Atlantic, but under Miami, where it's coming up through the porous limestone, and then you have water, continuous flow of water under Miami from the Everglades, going out to the Atlantic. And so as the Atlantic rises and puts more pressure, it backs up the whole system. And that's one reason that we're already seeing so much of this sunny day flooding in Miami, and why before too many more years, we don't know exactly how many, Miami is going to look more like the Florida Keys. It'll be a chain of some islands that are the ground that's above 10 feet above sea level, and everything else will be underwater, and the Keys by then will be gone.
Right, and people might be interested to check out this article by you and your son. Yeah, sorry about that, Stan Cox. Your son's name, Paul Cox, right?
Right.
Because in it, you talk about how Miami looked, I mean, hundreds of thousands of years ago, and you know, the differences in sea levels there. But we are you know, Miami, we know, is at great risk. But there are other cities. I mean, look at what happened in Manhattan with Hurricane Sandy. And then Houston, isn't that basically built on a floodplain? And flying over Florida, the place in so many ways looks like fundamentally a swamp, you know, with bits of land. Just some final comments from you, Stan.
I wrote another book on air conditioning and opened the book with Southwest Florida, but it could have been in, well, I wrote about Houston also, but where it's only air conditioning that made those places even habitable. Where they were malarial swamps before it was possible.
Wow.
for people to live and work there. And they're just should not be that many people there. But now that there are, we're going to have to deal with it.
Absolutely. Well, hopefully we'll come back to this discussion and you'll be able to join us again. We appreciate you taking time to join us, Stan Cox.
Enjoyed it. Thanks.
All righty. We're out of time. Today's show produced by Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team, our longtime intern, Sherelle Withers. Sherelle, you rock. Our assistant producer, Stephanie Case, and our engineer, Mr. T, Teddy Robinson. If you'd like a copy of today's show, please contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow for our weekly round table. You won't want to miss that. It's been a while for our roundtable and there's a lot going on, so be sure to tune in. Thank you for listening. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.